He begins by dealing only with the land issue, not with the, taking Ruth as a wife issue, and the kinsman redeemer, the so-and-so, as we're calling him, is all for it at that point. And then Boaz is going to bring up Ruth, and that's where we are right now. So any comments or questions, just, where we are. All right. So, Mary Dunn, would you read for us chapter 4, verses 5 and 6?
Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it."
And I had asked you guys to do a little bit of thinking on this yourself, and I'm not trying to point out whether you did or did not, but I would just like to see if anybody has, wrestled with this a little bit and would like to make any comment. What is it that is most changing in this Redeemer's mind? Why he can't do it? Like, it's almost immediate. I will do it. No, I won't do it. What is it that you think brings this about? Why is the another way to put this? Why is the inclusion of Ruth a bad deal? Messes up his own inheritance. How, Mary? Okay, selfishness. But how would it mess up his own inheritance? I agree with you on that. But how? Okay, so this man, he has an inheritance, okay? And then he's going to receive into that, not a good marker, he's going to receive into that another inheritance, right, of Elimelech. But inclusion in that is Ruth. So to get the inheritance is a good thing for him. But if you include Ruth in it, it's not a good thing. So technically, the bringing in of this inheritance is not, it's not like you're just adding Ruth to here. Are you following that? It's not like she's actually going to take away what is the rights of his inheritance. That's a good thought. Maybe it's age. She's so much younger. Okay. I want you guys to think about this. Yeah, he probably did have a wife and probably did have sons. And it's possible the wife is the real reason. She's just against it. My wife's not gonna be happy about this, right? So that's a legitimate It could be who she is, okay? Although Boaz has already, and the writer have already made clear that her reputation is still very good in the whole community. So that's, but that is a part of it, yep. Here's part of this, okay? If he just gets the land, this inheritance will be his pretty much forever. He's going to get that inheritance. Be like, "Hey, man, do you want to acquire that field? Yeah, I'll take it. Free of charge, I get that field. Maybe there's some purchase to Naomi, but largely he's going to get that field." Now, Naomi and Ruth would be a part of the deal in the sense that they would have to be taken care of. that make sense? So he's going to have some sacrifice that he's going to have to make. He's getting this land, which is going to produce for him income, which he's going to enjoy. And part of that income is going to be deferred by his care of taking care of Naomi and Ruth. Or at least Naomi. Maybe he's not even thinking about Ruth. But it still is a pretty good deal. Naomi's old. She's going to die pretty soon. I get this land. Wow, this is a great deal. When you bring Ruth into the picture, he not only is going to have to provide for her for a longer amount of time, right? Because she's younger, so he's going to have to provide for her. But if he does do this provision of an heir, okay, this land will revert back to the heir. I don't know what time, year of Jubilee or, you know, what, I mean, it's going to revert back to him. So if there's no heir, this is going to permanently become a part of his estates. But if there is an heir, this is going to go back to the heir. He's got more people to take care of, right? More cost involved. His wife probably not too happy about it anyway. And he's not going to actually get this land for very much time. So it goes from being a very lucrative offer to being something that is at least questionable. We don't know how long he's going to get this land, how long he's going to be able to have it, and he's going to have to give it back to this heir after shucking out a good amount of money to raise the heir, right? So the whole position becomes not a good business deal. Good business deal, not a good business deal. Okay, so think about how you choose decisions in life. Is this a good deal for me? Is it not a good deal for me? Right? That's how we a lot of times make decisions, right? It's not wise if it's not a bad, if it's a bad deal for me, it's not a good decision. Now contrast that with the way Boaz is thinking. Is Boaz thinking just about what is a good deal for him? He's thinking about Hesed. He's thinking about covenant faithfulness. See, every part of this story, whether it's Ruth when she chooses to go back with Naomi, or whether it's Boaz here, there's a contrast between what is practically good and wise and what is Hesed. And what is being encouraged in this passage is Hesed. True covenant faithfulness, covenant loyalty, even if the deal is not that good. Okay? And I would assume that take away the wife portion of it, that every other aspect of this is true. You could put Boaz here, right? He has an inheritance. He's going to bring Ruth into that. She's actually going to take some of his inheritance. Now, he's going to have an heir, but he's getting the same deal that this other man would. It's not like it's a different deal that he's getting. And you might say, well, he loves Ruth, and that's true. But it's not just what we would call romantic love, although I think that's there. I think it is Hesed. And that is what's driving him. And that is what the writer of Ruth really wants us to get. Okay? Let's see. Yeah.
In all this, apparently the kinsman redeemer was not obligated to be the kinsman redeemer.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that's so it was just simply an act of love on his part if he concluded whatever redemption was required. Anyway, I don't fully understand. It's a little bit foreign to me.
No, but that is what I believe most of us, when we read the book of Ruth, pass right over. If you go to Levirate marriage in Deuteronomy, let me just read Deuteronomy. Well, let's turn to Deuteronomy 25 for a moment. Beginning in verse 5. These are the laws of Levirate marriage. Okay? And I remind you, as we look at these laws, what is the timing of Ruth? Big picture. Where does Ruth fit into the history? Say, Erica? The judges. Now, in the time of the judges, were God's people known for caring in detail about the law? Everybody's doing as he saw fit, right? So the fact that this is occurring at the time of the judges is going to help me understand this. So let's look at the verses 5 through 10 of Deuteronomy 25. Mike Starnes, why don't you read for us?
Husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, my husband's brother refuseth to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed.
Okay, so what are some things that you see in that passage about this? Things that strike you. As difficult as it may be, put your blinders on the whole issue of adultery. And I know that's hard, but what other things come out in the passage? Yes, there is a duty, and to not fulfill it is full of shame. Okay? How is that shame expressed? They spit in his face. By the way, that's still a very not a good thing to do in our own land. if you spit in a cop's face, you can be serious. It's a serious crime. So I know that from personal, not truly personal experience, but but association, let's put it that way. So it's not a good thing. Spit is universally not a good thing. The sandal. Now, do you recognize that in this situation, who takes the sandal? Who's doing the action here? Yeah, the woman actually goes and takes the sandal, right, from him, and then spits in his face. And the man will be always known as what? His line, yeah. His line's like cut off, known as like, that's the line that wouldn't do as right as a kinsman redeemer. Not as the man who escaped adultery. So all of this is, this is Deuteronomic law. It is to be received, not judged. It is to be received by God's people as the standard of which they had to handle this. Notice there is a gate, and the woman calls the man to the gate, right? So in the legal proceedings, right? She's going to go up. She's going to declare he won't do it, and therefore he's going to be have his sandal taken off. Now, and I would tell you that to have your name blotted out of the land of Israel, like to lose your name, is to lose your place in heaven in glory. So like to not, that's why this is so important. So we just tend to think, oh, you'll just be poor in land and you'll, you know, who cares? We because we don't associate heaven with this earth, we just think, well, it doesn't matter what you have here. You can be a homeless person, you can go to glory. So the issue of adultery is far more important to us than the issue of having a piece of land. But if your connection to the land and having your name and as a place in the land was the sign that you actually have a place in eternal glory, that kicks it up a notch. To no longer have a place in the land means that you do not have any place in glory, technically. The way that this is working out in redemptive history. I know that on the big picture, that's not true. You don't have to have a place in the land. But in this period of time, to have a place in land is salvation to them. To not have a place, to be blotted out of Israel. They're talking about your name not being connected in the land itself. You don't have a place in eternal glory. Okay? So, take that over to the back to Ruth, okay? Ruth chapter 4, 7 through 12. And it's good for us to compare those two. Who wants to read that? Somebody raise their hand. Who'd like to read that? All right, Christian. I got you, Patty. I'll get you next time.
Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witness this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witness this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman."
Okay. All right. That's good that we read that all in its entirety, but we still got to break it down a lot. The first thing that you see mentioned in verse 7, he says, now this was what? The custom. Does he say this is the law? It's not. So I think that what we're dealing with is a general custom. And my opinion is that custom has it actually predates the law. So in Leviticus, the woman takes off the sandal and then spits in the guy's face. But there's no real explanation. What does taking off of the sandal even mean in Leviticus? Right? We just kind of have to infer that. But in Ruth, we're told that there is this custom having to do with the sandal, that when you want to confirm a deal, you give your sandal. But who takes the sandal off? the person. You take it off yourself. You give it to them. It's kind of like signing your name in a legal contract. Okay, so this custom is there that you take off the sandal. The Levitical law, it doesn't change that custom. It just applies it. Instead of that man should have taken off his shoe and given it to you, you have a right to go grab it and take it from him and spit in his face. Do you see how the custom had to predate and be something that was larger than the law itself? That's how you understand the law, is that it fits into this cultural context. So in the case of Ruth, are they really that concerned with the Levitical law? It doesn't seem like it. Because if they were, Ruth or Naomi would have had a right to go up to this man, demand that you be my kinsman redeemer, and if he doesn't do it, rip his sandal off. They weren't even there. They didn't even bring the woman. You know, so this is why Ruth I've heard plenty of sermons in my life, probably given some, I don't know, about the kinsman redeemer, and it just kind of like, oh yeah, he's the kinsman redeemer, Boaz is kinsman redeemer, this is really great, it fits to the Old Testament Levirate law. It really doesn't fit. Not exactly. Which, by the way, I think is intentional in Ruth. Because Ruth is not primarily about simply following laws. Ruth is about covenant chesed, covenant love. There was no law that told Ruth she had to come back with Naomi, and yet she does. That's chesed. It's important in this situation that we don't say, well, Boaz just had to do this. You need to feel that Boaz is acting out of covenant love in this situation. Okay? Now, does it relate to the kinsman redeemer? Yes. It does. But I don't think the kinsman redeemer in its entirety, in its fullness, is really lived out until Christ himself. That he takes us, the church, as a bride to himself. So, yes. Not to my knowledge. The wording, and I had that in my notes. I'm so bad at remembering stuff. But Boaz does actually have a meaning, and some people try to draw from that. But Jachin and Boaz, as far as I know, I'm not saying there isn't. Just because I don't know it doesn't mean there's not a good reason, good meaning. But I don't know. I don't know it that in my studies of Scripture. I haven't. And I don't see anywhere that they make a connection between those two. So, might be, but I just haven't seen it yet. Okay.
In the Jewish law. She is outside the Jewish law. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting insight into the true Redeemer, mm-hmm, in terms that the Gentiles were invited into the family of God. Ruth is being invited into the family of God.
That's absolutely right. And she's done so on the basis of the covenant love of Boaz. That is the, I mean, this is Gentile, inclusion. The only difference that I can see is that in this context, in the Old Testament context, a Gentile can be brought into the covenant community and included in that, but does so by taking on the whole covenant responsibility. Whereas in the New Covenant, you don't have to take on all the Jewish ceremonial laws, and you just have faith in Christ. So there is a difference in that way. But no, there's no question that Ruth is put forward as this ideal that God would reach out and give covenant love to Gentiles. Absolutely, yep. Now, But it would have been easy to put this whole thing as just kind of stated that way. God wanted to save Ruth, bring her into the covenant community. He works in Boaz's heart. Boaz falls in love with her. He brings her in, and by marriage, they're together. But instead, the writer of Ruth has other concerns going on. And those concerns have to do with the customs of the people. The writer of Ruth doesn't just want to have the people of God go, "We hate this. We don't like this. You may accept Ruth, Boaz, but we don't accept Ruth." That's very important. He wants, the writer, and I think Boaz and Ruth, want everyone to be happy with the situation. And that also connects with the inclusion of the Gentiles, that it needs to be everyone to go, "Yes, this is a glorious thing that he's brought in Gentiles," not, "I can't believe this." Now think about what the Pharisees do when Christ does bring in Gentiles. They hate it, right? So in this situation, there's a real attempt to get everyone to say, this is done correctly. It's not like in violation. It's not underhanded or sneaky. It's done the way it should be done. And everyone says, "Amen, this is glorious." Okay, that's where we're heading right now for the rest of this. Okay. So in order to do that, you have to have witnesses. And the rest of this passage is all about the witnesses saying this is good. Okay? So look at verse 11. Oh, by the way, before we even do that, remember, there's a focus on buying, right? I've bought the land and I have bought my wife. Certainly that can relate to Christ having purchased his people. But in that situation, it's not like a degradation on the woman. He's seeing Ruth as a part of the overall inheritance. And so kind of like with the adultery thing, we just think, "Oh, that's terrible. Why could you buy Ruth?" But it's just the language that they used, that she becomes a part of his estate. Women were a part of the headship of the male over his entire inheritance. And so he's purchasing the woman along with that. So I just don't want people to get too messed up in that. So who are the witnesses in verse 11? That's right. And when they say we're witnesses, what are they witnessing to? Yeah. Yes. So according to, ultimately we would hope it would be according to Levitical law, but really in their day, according to the customs that they were living by. So that at that time, you know, these elders are ruling, they're making judgments, they could clearly see if something was wrong. So if they felt like Boaz was trying to sneak in and get something that should belong to somebody else, that would have been bad. And so this is all presented in a way that the elders make their judgment. We're witnesses. This is done correctly. Even if we would say it's not done exactly to Levitical law. Yeah.
I mean, Boaz bought the stuff.
I don't know.
The land. And I mean, I assume...
I don't have it. We were talked about that. Maybe you weren't here.
I wasn't.
Yeah, you weren't here. We talked about how this idea of some commentators want to say that it's not really buying. I don't know. It's confusing to me, and I just, I don't have a good answer for who he's paying or what he's paying or, I don't know. So they are witnesses, and then they say, "What about the woman? What do they want?" They actually pronounce a blessing, right? What's the huh? Yeah. So what's this blessing, Nathan Graybill?
She have offspring that, and the fact that they refer to her to be like Rachel and Leah, I think is pretty important as well.
Yeah. So why is Rachel and Leah important? Women of good repute, maybe. I mean, they kind of do some underhanded things. But if you're looking at Israel as a people, okay, you have Jacob, and you have Rachel and Leah, and then you have two other ladies, right? But they do in the sense that their children are the actual tribes of Israel, right? But their handmaidens also are included, okay? But when you say Rachel and Leah, you are basically saying this is the entirety of God's people. Lineage. And what they're saying to Ruth, may you and your children not just have a lot of kids, but may you be like truly members of Israel. That's what they're saying. That's a good question. I don't know if there's an element of prophecy here where they speak better than they know, or if they really, maybe this is a type of blessing that was maybe typical in that day, but maybe they don't understand the fullness of what is going on. She's not just given a place in Israel. She's being called as a, given one of the most prominent places, right up there with Rachel and Leah. It's amazing. We, like Ruth, are brought into the people of God. And we're given a place. Maybe not the same place as Ruth, but we should yearn for that. And I think it's also a biblical yearning that you should want to have children and want those children to be spiritual children of God, a part of that blessing. The second element, may you act worthily in Ephrathah, that's just Israel, be renowned in Bethlehem. And basically they're saying, Boaz, we want you to have a glorious name, that you would be one of covenant chesed. We would lift up your name, Boaz, in that way. And then in verse 12, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. What's the significance of Perez and Tamar? So we've got Rachel and Leah. Now we got Perez. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ken? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and in this situation, it seems, and this is not really all that out of place. It doesn't seem like the people of that day are really defined by the Levitical law, it makes sense because the Levites weren't doing their job, probably teaching the people. But it does seem like they knew the history, which is typical, right? We know the Bible stories, but we don't always know all the laws that go behind those. So they know the history about Perez. And in that situation, Judah, who's obviously Judah a good guy in general, I mean, he's like the founder, right? He's the line from which Christ comes. Judah says to Tamar, you are more righteous than me. Which is a big part of the book of Ruth. This Moabite woman and Boaz, you know, they are the righteous ones, not the typical so-and-so that's looking out for himself. He repents, and Perez is the result, right? And Perez is the name. And so, again, in all of this, somehow they recognize that what Boaz is doing is significant. Even if they don't understand the details of the law, they know that this is a pretty amazing thing. And they're recognizing that. All right. Any questions on this so far? So the people, the elders, praising, excited, blessing. What about verse 13? Patty, would you read that for us? All right, so... what strikes you in this verse, Nikki Patton? What is striking to you in this verse? Yes. The Lord has not been mentioned. Like, what his active actions have not been mentioned. Right? We can recognize that God's hand of providence is moving all along this, but at this point, God opens her womb. Which is, I mean... almost striking at this point. And she bears a son. I think it makes you go back and say, well, how come Ruth didn't have a son when she was in Moab? How would the story have been different if she had had sons back in Moab? She probably wouldn't even have come. Right? Yahweh is working even through the barrenness of their previous marriages. I wonder how much they wrestled with God, maybe not even the Yahweh, but just what's going on, why am I barren? And I think even into our day, how often do we doubt when God doesn't answer our prayers the way we want him to? And in this situation, God was working through everything that previously went on. His sovereign hand working in Elimelech to leave the land. You know, his sovereign working in the children dying, no heirs. His sovereign working in bringing them back. I mean, he's working through all of this. They couldn't see it at the time, but he was working. And that's, I think, a big lesson for us. And I think that's one that the writer wants us to see. Because he's ultimately about your faith. And I'm guilty of letting the unanswered prayers or the worries and cares of this life to squeeze out my love for God. Right? And it's just encouraging to see that the Lord was working here. Okay, so this is like the one interjection that tells us that God is active, Yahweh is there. Verses 14 and 15. Melissa Dunn, you want to read those for me?
The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons."
Okay. Now, this is all about Naomi, okay? And the women. Number one, when Ruth has this child, what is the testimony of the women? So we've already got the elders' testimony. We've got kind of the people's testimony in general. But what about the women? Are they happy with this? They are extremely happy, right? Uh, So they call her blessed. Remember that we talked about that Naomi at the beginning of the book was in a descent of bitterness and emptiness. And now the women are recognizing that she's in her fullness. Okay? To not have this statement of Naomi, to just leave it with Ruth, would not be a completion of this, what's going on in the story. There definitely needs to be Naomi brought back in. Who is the Redeemer? That's right. At this point, it is the Son that is really the one who redeems Naomi. So Ruth's kinsman redeemer is obviously Boaz. But remember, Naomi doesn't just want to, she doesn't want to just come back in the land and live a nice life in this world. She wants a son that will perpetuate her name in the land of Israel. And so this son is her redeemer. And I think it's interesting that these women are hoping that the son's name be renowned in Israel. And obviously on all kinds of practical levels, he'll be a restorer of life to her, nourisher to her in her old age. So she's going to end up taking care of him some of the time, but really the son's going to be a blessing to her, and that actually works as well, right? Those of you who have grandchildren, you know what a blessing it is to have a grandchild. How it seems to bring life back. I'm completely convinced that my dad and my mom are as healthy as they are partly because of grandkids, just because they see a lot of joy. My parents went up and picked Michael up and took him out to eat yesterday, and there's just they have a pleasure in that and a joy in that, so it's a good thing. But then they make the most amazing statement. They're all about the son. May he have a great name. But what do they acknowledge about Ruth? Better than seven sons. Better than seven sons. This is not a belittlement of men. Oh, yeah, worthless men. You know, this is an exaltation of the chesed of Ruth. She has given to you what seven sons couldn't give to you. What did she give to Naomi? What did she give to her? Her covenant love. That's what she needed. She is the hand by which God gives covenant love to Naomi. And I just think it's beautiful in this passage how much the writer wants to honor her in that. In a male-dominated society, right? That they're willing to honor Ruth in this way. Ruth embodies, as one commentator says, more than anything else in the history of Israel, Ruth embodies the fundamental principle of the nation's ethic. You shall love the Lord, love your God with all your heart, and your neighbor as yourself. In Leviticus 19:34, Moses instructs Israelites to love the stranger as they love themselves. Ironically, it is the stranger from Moab who shows the Israelites what this means. So Naomi's faith?
It was somewhat of a blind faith that she followed, but she was looking at this woman and saying, I see in you something I see in no one else. And
yeah, and I think I'm going to piggyback on what you're saying and kind of expand it a little bit. Early on, Naomi's faith is at a flicker. It is down to a small flame, but it's still there. The whole story of Ruth is a story that says God does not despise the flickering faith. And so this is definitely a story of God bringing Naomi back to a strong faith. And in a sense that God is for her. Because down here she feels like he's against her, even though he's still her God. But he's bringing her back. And I think even at this point, all along this path, but really at this point, Ruth is seeing the faith of Naomi. So that's good. Well said. Yeah. Okay, so 16 and 17. Lee, why don't you read this for us? Oh, no voice. Brenda, would you read?
Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David.
Okay, so a couple things you see. Obviously, Naomi gets to, in a sense, be the put the child on her lap means that she has some responsibility taking care of him. Some people want to push it, I think, too far and say that Ruth's not doing any of the taking care of him. She's just giving him up to Naomi, and I don't think that's true. But it's clear that Naomi is enjoying this child and in some sense imparting blessing to him and taking on responsibilities. This is a fulfilled grandma. So it's a good picture. But then it's noticed the women of the neighborhood do what? Now again, I don't think this, and this is, maybe I'm wrong in this, I wouldn't disdain somebody if they said, hey, Boaz and Ruth had no part in the naming. It was just the people of the community. But I tend to feel like Boaz and Ruth did have a part in the naming of the child. But the writer is trying to tell us that the community is fully participating in saying, yes, we are. This man has a name in Israel. So it's more of that. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So, I don't know. It is pretty amazing. Short for Obadiah. So Obed is short for Obadiah, and it is some. Obadiah means the servant of Yahweh. So in this situation, could you shorten it to say just one who serves? That might be a way to say it. It's certainly about service. And this child certainly serves the whole community. So we've gone full board. We've done the whole, everybody that could possibly be a part of criticizing this child, nobody criticizes. Nobody's going to come back up a couple years later and say he's not legitimate. Everybody in the community says yes and amen. I think that's the point of this chapter of ending of Ruth. All right, so finally, at the end, genealogy. So let's see. Let's have... Yeah, okay. Brenna, you get ready to read the names. I'll give you a heads up. You can look at all those names. So go ahead, Christian.
I'm just wondering why the author has never named, and like, how long did it take for this book to be written after the events took place?
Yeah, that's both good questions. A lot of times in Scripture, the authors are not named. So I'm going back to my early notes just to see here. Obviously, it has to be a significant time after, sometime significant after the actual story, because the writer seems to have to tell us that it was the custom of that day. Right, so that could be an editorial comment, right? Because he has to like explain the custom that was somewhat lost of this whole sandals. My best guess, and it's not a complete guess. How far does the genealogy go down, David? I'm guessing that this had to have been written after David, so it was either written during David's reign, or maybe Solomon's reign. And I think it's written as, in part, as a way of legitimizing and getting people on board with David as the rightful king. So some people want to push it a lot later. I'm not comfortable with that. I think it's probably during David or Solomon's reigns that it was actually written. Who it was written by, I don't know. I think there was probably oral history. So in other words, this story was probably carried on, maybe even through the women. This is, you know, and so then the writer actually is compiling that and putting it down in writing. Yes, Ken, you're obviously disturbed at something.
No, just I'm not disturbed. Wasn't there, when David was fleeing Saul, he hid his parents with some foreign prince. Was that a Moabite prince?
Yes, and then he later goes and wipes out Moabites. So, I mean, he does. But yes, it was a Moabite that he sent them down there during his run. So it's this connection with the Moabites and stuff is obviously there even during David's time. So yeah, but does that answer your question? I don't know. It could have been a woman, could have been a man that wrote this. I don't know. And it was not, in my opinion, the writer does not, he's not like Luke, who when Luke writes, he says, I'm going around and doing research. I think this was probably a known story that was perpetuated, probably orally, from generation to generation. Yep. Now, some of the Jewish scribes didn't like Ruth that much, because it doesn't really paint the established church very well. It's actually, you've got to learn from those outside. And so there was some dispute over whether Ruth should actually be included in the canon. I have no doubt that it should have been and that it is inspired. But when you start thinking about this on the writing of books of the Bible, you often come to the question, man, how did this come about? And that story is one you'll have to learn in heaven, I think. So. All right, Brenna, would you read the genealogy for us?
Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David.
Okay, so this, and you're going to have to trust me on this because I'm not going to take a whole lot of time. We can, if you want to dispute it, you can do that too. This is not the complete genealogy. Okay, there are. It's kind of like Walter Clark is the son of Clark, meaning Big Clark. There's some generations that are skipped. Is all I'm saying. Okay, it's not that it's a bad genealogy, but again, the writer is trying to show us explicitly some important truths out of this genealogy, besides just giving us a bunch of names that we're not familiar with. So, what are the things that you notice? How many generations are there? Ten generations. And if you remember back to the Moabites being included, part of that is in the tenth generation. So, also ten is certainly a number of completion. Where is Boaz in the picture? Seventh in line. In a culture that values these kind of things, I think that there's an honoring in a subtle way that is going on with Boaz and obviously of David as well. Obviously, then we are to acknowledge that David is the the legitimate king, and therefore the one in whom the true kinsman redeemer Christ would come. But all that we know from our perspective, not from their perspective. So, all right, we've got a couple minutes. I just want to hear from you how you might take a lesson from the story of Ruth and apply it to your own life. Doesn't matter which one, doesn't have to be the most profound one. Just something about Ruth that you're going to take and apply to your life. That's an excellent lesson. That's an excellent lesson. Right in line. Perfect. Other lessons. Self-interest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't just think about personal self-interest. Think about being faithful to your covenant, God, and loving him and loving your neighbor. Excellent. That's excellent. Other applications. Ken? So like Boaz, what he does, he's like Elimelech. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. Very good. Ah. Yeah, it's hard as a pastor to admit that your faith might at times be flickering. But I've definitely felt that at times. And thankful that God didn't abandon me during those times. So that's an excellent. Others? Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Sure. Yep. Yep. That's a good point. Any others? You guys are all doing great. Giving another person yeah. That's great. That is an excellent application. It was nothing big in the land. It was just taking care of one person. What an incredible, beautiful thing. There are more, but we're out of time. So thank you guys. Thank you very much. We're going to go into the book of Mark. So that's where we're moving. I will forever be thankful for my study in Ruth, and I feel like I've gotten a deeper, fuller understanding of my God, how great he is, how much he loves me, how much he's not trying to stand over me and nitpick any little fault, but I think that's similar to what Erica's talking about, but just knowing his faithful love towards me and that it encourages me not to just go on doing what I want, but encourages me to be more chesed, to live more in faith, to be the man I'm supposed to be. So, Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the blessing that it is. It is truth that penetrates deep into my heart. And I pray, Father, that your spirit would make it alive in each person here, that they would know your goodness and your faithfulness to them, because you